Thank you, Rich, and thank you to everyone that that read this evening. At this juncture, I get to introduce the speaker for the evening. For those that are your patients here, have been patients here for a while, you've seen this man's face. He's here almost every men's meeting. He's on the weekends. He does a lot of service work. And I always have to say this about Gary is my very first meeting. I was in the evening IOP program. Hey, Donna.
Hey, Donna.
And they made me start going to meetings when we didn't have IOP. And the very first one I went to was the men's night out meeting at 6 o'clock on Wednesdays. And when I went to that meeting, there was Gary and another gentleman out front, and they kind of glared at me as I was walking up, and as I walked by and I said hello, I swear they both growled at me. So I was nervous from the beginning, but Gary has probably one of the biggest hearts that you ever come across in this program. If you need anything, Gary's going to be there. He's been such a big part of my recovery too. So I'm really, really excited to introduce you to Gary.
If I can find a place to hide all my stuff, you gotta have a place to put your stuff. I saw all of you when it started lighting and the lights were flickering. You thought you was gonna get out of here without having to listen to it. I'm here tonight doing this because I have a fear of speaking in front of people. So now that I've got you hostage, I'm going to work out my fears on you. I was born out in a little hamlet called Villarica out in West Georgia, and I was born to country folks, salt of the earth, some of them anyway, and you know, there were a lot of characters my family was crazy, is what I'm trying to say. And all of them had a nickname, and everything had a nickname. I had two uncles, Big Baldy and Little Baldy. And on Saturday afternoon, Big Baldy and Little Baldy would go get in Huldy, which was an old 38 Ford coupe. They call it that because there was no interior in it, just a hull and stuff. And they would leave to go to the Legion Hall in Villarica because that's the only place you could get a drink poured. And, you know, I observed all that, and it seems that I was on a negative course from the very beginning because I always looked up to people that didn't give a damn. And that, you know, I wanted to be like them but the problem was, is I did care. We were churchgoers, went 3 times a week, fundamentalist church, spare the rod, spoil the child. If you thought it was just as bad as if you had done it. So, I tell you what, if whacking on a child would make them righteous, I'd had to bring my halo in with me tonight. Because I got a lot of it, got it often. But as years went by, the punishment never fit the crime. It was way overboard, and my mother was deadly with a shoe. She could hit you all the way across the building you know, and stuff. And, you know, yeah, it was a strange situation because, you know, they would punish you and then tell you not to cry. And I'll never forget one time I was whimpering, and I don't know if, I think it was my mother said, "You better shut up or I'll give you something to cry about." And I said, "I think you've done good enough." Whap, bang, and slam. Yeah. Yeah. But over the years through the teachings of the church and observing the people in the church and what they did and what they said was two different things altogether. And, you know, by the time I was in, say, 10 years old, I started having problems. You know, I started having migraine headaches, anxiety, and, you know, we had moved from Villarica up to a little place in North Georgia called Ellijay, and it was really rural. So, you know, it was hard to get accustomed to being around other people when you're never around other people, you know. And with my anxiety and everything, you know, I was just a weird kid. You know, I mean, I tried so hard. I tried too hard. And I'd be around grown-ups especially and try to impress on them how intelligent I was and how much I knew about everything. And, you know, it made for more isolation because people didn't feel comfortable around me. And you know, I started, around that time, I started joking to get my way, get out of a place where, you know, I was real nervous and real frustrated and everything, so I make a joke out of everything, you know. And some people in my family, you know, I'd be laughing about something, and to this day I still do it. And people still kid me about it, you know, that I'll just be sitting thinking about something, I think it's funny, and I'll laugh. But when I was a kid, they used to say, "What's he laughing about?" And my mother would say, "Oh, that's just useless. He's telling himself another joke." So, you know, now, all this anxiety, I don't really remember when it all came about, but, you know, I do remember the very first time that I had a drink of alcohol, and I was about 6, and my legs were hurting. They were just aching and stuff, and I found out later that's called growing pains, but in Villarica we just called it the leg ache, you know, so, but... But I had the leg ache, and my uncle had a beer, and he gave me a couple of swallows out of this. And 6 years old, you remember what brand it was? It was a Falstaff. Yeah. And you know, my legs stopped hurting. But there was also this thing where I got this feeling, and it wasn't a drunk feeling, but I felt like everything is right with the world. Now, it wasn't like I went down to the corner store and bought a six pack the next day, because I was 6 years old, come on. But you know, I ended up being a real angry person after I got, 16, 17 years old. I was real angry. And I was angry at God. I was angry at my family for what I felt like was abuse. Maybe back then it wasn't, but today it is. I guarantee you that. They lock people up for some of that stuff. But it's a hard way to start life when you're mad at the world. And you're mad at God, and you're mad at everything. But you know, when you're young and you're kind of a bad boy, mad at the world, you're real attractive. Angry young man. But when you get to be an old man, it's not too attractive anymore. I had problems early on because I didn't trust anybody. I wanted to do everything my way. And let me tell you, I had some bright ideas about how to live this life. And, I did stupid things. The first stupid thing I did after I left home was I found a woman that I could not get along with, and I married her. Bright idea, right? Well, she was as damaged as I was, and, bless her heart, she had this idea that because we'd had relations before we got married, that her mother died. And I was going like, we don't have that much power, and we stayed married for like 2 years because another one of my bright ideas was I would work for a quarter when I was in college. I worked for a quarter because I was always broke. So I was going to work for a quarter and then go back the next quarter. Well, this is in the days when you used to get this letter in the mail that said, your Uncle Sam wants you. Now, report. You had like 2 days to get your stuff together and leave and stuff. And so for that 2 years I was in the Army, that's about the same amount of time that we stayed married. When I came back home, not so much. We just could not get along and stuff. And just a quick byline to that is, It wasn't a nice divorce. It was really bad and stuff. And over the years, I had worried about some of the things that I'd said and done. Most of the things I worry about that I say and do, the other person forgotten it years ago, but it still bothers me. But my brother-in-law died of this disease been almost 2 years ago now. And, my higher power gave me the opportunity to go to that man's funeral and tell his sister that I was sorry and God bless her. Yeah. So, we go through this program, we get down there, step nine, we think well, I got to go out and tell everybody I'm sorry. Well, no, you don't. It says you got to be willing and to do what you can when you can, is what it's saying to me. And so a lot of amends that I've made over the years, it was a lot of years in the making. But, you know, with social media now, you can find just about anybody. And so some of the amends I've made in the past few years is I look somebody up on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, find them, send them a message, and apologize, and send them, a couple cases, send money when I had put the shaft to them. Yeah. My college roommate, I hadn't been, what he had done when we were in college together, his name was Jeff Melton. And it never occurred to me that was his middle name. And I've been looking for him for years. Then I found him under Fred J. Melton and stuff. Now, he was an accountant. And I finally got in touch with him. I said, I'm going to send you the money that I owed you years ago. He said, don't worry about it. It's no big deal and everything. But I got cash and put it in the envelope and sent it to him so he couldn't. If it's a check, he could tear it up. Nobody tears up cash. But then him being an accountant, he messaged me and said, that amount of money that you sent me compounded quarterly over. See where we're at here. College, okay. The military was okay. It was a bad time to be in the military because nobody cared. Vietnam was winding down, and I was in Germany, but I did learn how to smoke hashish when I was over there. It was, you know, I had a 9-to-5 job, 5 days a week, and so I got to travel all over Europe. You can get on a train in Europe. If you got military papers, you can go and go and go. You don't have to have a passport, anything, just, you know. So I got to see Europe on the weekends. And didn't get in too much trouble. Had a landlady. I didn't live on post. I had a landlady, and she'd get mad at me because I took a bath every day. Well, they don't take a bath every day. And I could have complained about that, but you know, but I brought her coffee. Is a very expensive thing in Germany, like a quarter kilo was even back then was like $10. You know, that's about a little over a half pound, you know, and so I went to the PX and bought her one of those 3-pound tins of Folgers coffee and took it to her. And she was so happy that the next day I had a case of the Giesner Brauhaus beer sitting on my doorstep. I don't know why I got off into that, but she was a pleasant lady. But In Germany, they drank beer like we have a cup of coffee at 10 o'clock. It's just part of their culture. While I was over there, I really couldn't tolerate it, because one beer would lay you out, really lay you out. But I'll get back to having that weird sense of humor that a lot of people don't understand. Some get it, some don't, you know. But I mean, the things that I think are funny, let me just tell you a little story. This benevolent king lived in some jungle or Sahara or whatever, and he loved his people, and he did all he could for them, but they were a very poor tribe. It was coming up on the 10-year anniversary, and all his people scrapped together whatever they could and had him a throne built. And they had a big celebration to celebrate 10 years of him being their leader. And they partied way into the night and everything. And the king decided that he didn't want to leave his throne out all night because it could be stolen. So he put the throne on top of his grass hut. And the party died down, and he went to bed. In the middle of the night, the throne fell through the top of his grass hut and killed him. Right? So the moral of the story is, people who live in grass huts shouldn't stow thrones. See, some of you sick as I am. But to move on, throughout my life, the thing of drinking, it came gradually and stuff, but it sort of became my connection to other human beings, because I just didn't get it. I didn't get being around other people, and yeah, I had been kind of disturbed. And when I was in college, we didn't have enough money to party a whole lot, but I really did enjoy it. And my grades suffered really bad too because of it, because if it was between partying and studying, I was gonna party. And things did not go all that well. And that was one of the other reasons I was trying to back up and regroup when I got my butt drafted into the Army. But the relationship with my ex-wife, or my wife at the time, that had played out, and her mother had passed away while I was in the military, and my dad had passed away, and we just had no connection whatsoever. And we split up and went our different ways. Then I could really, I didn't have anybody nagging at me about partying too much and stuff. And it was not only alcohol. Alcohol was a mainstay, but different other powders and weeds and all that stuff, whatever, It's just that time in my life and everything. Well, I had come to a point where I just thought, what's the use? What's the use in even trying, you know. And every time that's come up in my life, it's been a bad thing. If I start thinking, what's the use, then something bad's about to happen. So that's one of the things about this program. When you start feeling like that, you can tell somebody about it, and they'll listen. And when they don't really have to give you any advice or anything, or tell you you need to change, just having somebody to listen really carries it on. But my attitude was so bad that I got where I was just unemployable. I was working as a land surveyor for Riley Park Hayden down in Atlanta and stuff, and I was always late. I was late 3 or 4 times a week. So my boss got really mad at me. I was about 20 minutes late one morning. Usually wasn't that much, but he told me, he said, "You come in here late one more time and you're fired." So I just, you know, I worked that day and I never went back because I knew I was going to be late, you know. And I frankly didn't care, you know. But, you know, my thinking and my bright ideas and everything, you know, then I had more time on my hands and I got in more trouble and stuff, and started getting into some criminal activity that just carried me in some bad places, and I did a lot of things I was ashamed of. But, you know, you drink enough, you're not really ashamed of anything. You know, just don't care. Just don't care. And, you know, anything that puts any pressure on you, on your life, you just drink it away and whatever. But I kept on getting in trouble with the law. And I had this attorney down in Atlanta that I'd known for several years. His name was Benjamin Landy, one of the finest human beings I ever met. And he not only did the legal part of the work, but he would sort of, you know, counsel me about my ways and stuff like that. And the last time I had to go to court on something very serious, after court he said, "You know, you're going to have to change your profession because you ain't no good at being a criminal." Because I always got caught, you know. I always got caught. Matter of fact, the last time, anytime I've ever been in front of this many people standing up, they said, "How do you plead?" I did straighten up. After that, I went back and got a regular job and started working. I bounced all over the place when I was in school. I was pre-law one day, history major the next. I was all over the place. You know, I mean, I had no idea and stuff. But after I got in all that trouble, there really wasn't a whole lot of demand for criminal history teachers or I don't think they even let you take the bar exam if you've but I don't know, I was bright enough to do that anyway. But I did not give up drinking, and no matter what happened, I did not give up drinking. And it got up in the 80s, and I'd been through so many relationships, you know, and I've talked about this to some of my friends and everything. I really didn't know how to have a relationship or to love anybody or anything, because like the Doors, excuse me, like the Doors song, don't you love her madly, don't you need her badly, don't you love her when she's walking out the door. And that's the only time I didn't think about it until they had had enough of me. And gentlemen, when a woman says she's through, forget about it. You can buy her a new house, you can buy her a new car, you can do whatever, but you know, she's done. And thank you very much for the house and the car. So, about 1986, I was in enough pain to show up at AA. Went to an old clubhouse up here in Marietta called the Rebos Club. That's sober spelled backwards, but you know, I did not drink. I didn't do much of anything else, but I did not drink for probably 6 years. And the longer I stayed sober, the madder I got. I was either mad at me or I was mad at everybody else. I either wanted to commit suicide or homicide, either one, whichever one, at that day. You know, I was just angry all the time. I could not get rid of it. So I just, you know, I went back to the drink, you know, because it seemed like the only thing at the time that made any sense, because I certainly didn't want to commit suicide. I always lived in kind of a dream world, you know, and when I perceived somebody had done me wrong or something, I was in this dream world, like how I was going to get back at them, and you know, what I should have done or what I should have said, I would get in those places and I couldn't sleep. So, yeah, I'd gone back to drinking and I thought I was going crazy. So, you know, I went to see a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist, I was telling him how I felt this way and all these angry feelings I had. And he said, well, just don't feel that way. And, you know, in my dream world, I thought of, you know, being Superman and flying across the desk and choking the guy, man. Like, what the hell are you talking about? But anyway, you know. And then I went to see a pastor. And he said, well, the problem is you drink too much. And I said, well, you just talk too much, you know. But I am proud to say that over the last 30 years, I've been sober more than I have drank. You get a belly full of AA and it'll mess you up about your drinking. You'll feel guilty every little sip, yeah. But this time around, if I live long enough, like 11 days, I'll have 7 years. So I don't want, please don't applaud. Take 30 years to get 7 years, you know, no applause, please. But the last go-around I had with this disease, I really couldn't tolerate, but I'd still try to drink because I felt like I had that same old feeling, what does it matter? Why does it matter? And it's like somebody reached over and turned on a switch one day. And I said, well, the only place that you've ever had any sort of comfort, had anybody that understood you, had anybody that listened to you, was in these rooms. The only place. So, you know, you don't want to admit that you're a lunatic. You don't want to admit that you're an alcoholic or whatever. So you fight it, and you fight it, and you fight it. I'll tell one more little story, if you don't mind. This lady had a son, and the son had a problem with bedwetting. So she was talking to her neighbor, and her neighbor said, well, how's your son doing? Well, he's not doing too good right now. We've had to send him to counseling, a psychologist, because he's been wet in the bed. Which her neighbor says, well, good luck with that, honey. So about 2 months later, she sees her neighbor again. Her neighbor says, hi there, how you doing? How's your son coming along in his therapy? She said, well, he's doing real good. He's making a lot of progress. She said, well, has he stopped wetting the bed? She said, no, but now he's proud of it. I can't tell you what it means to come to the realization that the only way, for me anyway, is to stop thinking about me. Stop it. One of my dear friends and alumni and otherwise, I go to her when I start having those thoughts of what does it matter anyway. And her advice is always the same. You got to double your efforts. You got to do more. Big Book tells you, if you don't have any self-esteem and you want some self-esteem, do good works. Well, this go-round, I try to do all the works I can and everything. We have a very special meeting on Saturday night that 95% of the people who attend that meeting are homeless. They're in the shelters. And, you know, just got out of jail, whatever. And I can relate to, because I was almost homeless many times, but I conned my way into somebody's life. But but to be of service to others, working the steps is very important, but living the steps is a whole different thing, you know, to live a life of service. I'll get it wrapped up here pretty soon. I'm not much on, it's what I call shining my own star. And I'm a little, because when I was growing up, drawing any attention to yourself was a bad thing. Yeah, it was a real bad thing. And so, you know, I know that there's no fellowship on this earth that is any better than this one. There's no place where you can go where you're loved. No matter how wacky you are, you might be a wacky person, but you know, you're tolerated and loved, and you may not be liked by everybody, but whether they like you or not, they'll help you. And that's a cut above just about anything or organization that I know. And I'll close up with this. Not drawing attention does not mean that I have to hide, sit in the back of the room, ride on the back of the bus. I don't have to do any of those things, but I do have to let the light shine. Now, there's a famous sermon that says the light that stands upon a hill cannot be hidden, but it don't say a strobe light that stands on a hill cannot be hidden. So I don't try to draw a lot of attention to myself, but I do love this program. And I think of a song that I learned when I was a kid, and it's a gospel song, but I'm not pretty, you know, I'm not getting it. But that song is called, it says, what a fellowship, what a joy divine, leaning on the everlasting arm. I hope that you can find a higher power, and I hope that you'll lean on the everlasting arms, and maybe it wasn't too bad for you tonight, and I hope that each of you will enjoy a life that's second to none. And with that, I'll say good night.
Thank you so much, Gary. I really appreciate it. Job well done, my friend.